Pack your bags. We're headed on a journey to the Galapagos Islands this hour to get the latest on a remarkable comeback for the giant tortoise population. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Kathleen Dunn. Over the centuries, these reptiles that can live to over 100 years old, they came to the brink of extinction. But now scientists are doing a wide variety of things to save them and their unique habitat. Joining us now is Professor James Gibbs. He's a conservation biologist, and he directs the Roosevelt Wildlife Station at the State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry. He's just returned from the Galapagos Islands. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, before we get into the giant tortoises, can you give us a bit of a geography lesson here? Tell us about the Galapagos Islands and where they are and what is unique about them.
Yes, it's always good to place them on a map. They are a very remote archipelago. They're 1,000 kilometers straddling the equator and due west of the western coast of South America. They're a possession of the Republic of Ecuador. So if you head straight west from Ecuador, nothing between them and the continent, but Pacific Ocean, you'll hit the Galapagos. They're very special because they've never been connected to the continent. They arose from their volcanoes. They're fairly young systems, but everything that lives on Galapagos today got there and evolved in isolation. And it's really why we see not particularly high diversity, but very unusual forms of life in Galapagos, because everything is endemic, has evolved there, and very long separated from the mainland.
And Charles Darwin learned a lot there as well.
Yes, indeed. Darwin, as a very young man, on the voyage of the Beagle, had a very impressionable experience in the Galapagos. It took decades for all of his insights to sort of coalesce, but the time he spent in Galapagos, seeing one island after the next with sort of repeats of different forms of animals, but each sort of slightly different and adapted to the unique circumstances of each island, I think is often argued as what catalyzed his larger vision of evolution. And Galapagos plays a very important role in stimulating that great revolutionary idea.
And fascinating to me is that 97% of the reptiles in the Galapagos Islands are found nowhere else on Earth.
Yes, this gets to the fact that great endemism, if not diversity, in the Galapagos. What got to Galapagos was a bit of a sweepstakes. You know, things we think came in terms of reptiles came to the Galapagos floating on rafts of vegetation. It just, I think, is a matter of chance that it happened to be giant tortoises that arrived and filled the niche that would have been filled by mammals or even large birds on other islands for herbivores. But that is indeed the case, and the same with lizards. Lizards arrived, and incredibly rich algal communities on the sea sort of, I think, created the draw for the evolution of the only seagoing lizard, which is the marine iguana. But it's again a bit of a sweepstakes. What arrived first, and then what filled the available niches? But in Galapagos, I think partly because of its great aridity, it's very dry and very hot, that reptiles happen to do a little bit better both en route and once they arrived.
Well, without further ado, tell us about these giant tortoises that roam the Galapagos Islands and what they look like, their physical attributes, their behaviors. What are they like?
Yes, they're really fascinating creatures. I mean, I've studied them for 30 years, and every new tortoise I see is a delight. They are indeed a giant. They are. We have records up to 500 pounds and more. They are. You know, they have massive shells. What's somewhat unusual in Galapagos, they're the only tortoises or turtles in the world with a saddle backing in some forms, which is the top part of the shell extends very, very high. But they're very large animals that, again, they're herbivores. The tortoise and the hare story is indeed true. They don't move very quickly, but they move steadily, and they actually are fairly migratory, moving up and down the sides of the volcanoes to seasonally to find things to eat. For me, they have this wonderful sort of wisdom and patience. I realize they're just reptiles, but they have always sort of an eye that's monitoring and assessing what's around them. They're very sort of gentle creatures. I've handled 5,000 or 6,000 of them, and you know, never a bite or anything like that. So they're just but they are very. It's good to look sometimes past their. They're just spectacularness in terms of their size, and they do very important things in the larger environment. And you know, they eat vast amounts of vegetation, they disperse huge amounts of seeds, and they're very powerful large animals, and they tend to move through things rather than around them. So they're basically engineers within their ecosystems, and so all these things together make them very important and very interesting creatures.
Giant tortoises have enjoyed perhaps some very positive public relations recently with the return of Lonesome George. He was this male Pinta Island tortoise who died in 2012. Can you tell us his story?
Yes, the Lonesome George story is a sad one. He was the last member of the Pinta Island giant tortoise species. Each island, major island in each large volcano, has its own species. We don't know. We think at one time there were 5,000 to 6,000 Pinta Island tortoises on this very northern island, the northernmost of all the islands that tortoises occur on. We know that whalers, because it took thousands of them, whaling captains kept very careful records, and we can see that. We know scientists at the beginning of the 1900s heard the species was going extinct, so they made a run from and to gather quite a few of the last ones for collections. There were reports into the 50s of a couple of tortoises remaining, but it wasn't until the early 1970s they were given up as extinct that an entomologist alone on this island blundered onto a tortoise. They sort of blundered onto one another, and that was the famous Lonesome George. And the next year he was brought into captivity. Further searches were made, very comprehensive ones of the island, and no other sign or tortoises were found. And Lonesome George then lived for 40 years, 40 years in captivity, really as a poster child for extinction and endangerment. And various efforts were made to breed him with other tortoises, if not to get purebred offspring, then hybrids. But he was a very solitary animal, and he really wanted no part of that. And sadly, he did die in 2012. And it was a very difficult set of decisions to be made. For example, should he be returned to his home island and buried with dignity, or should he be preserved in some fashion as a symbol for conservation? And the latter decision was made, and so began quite a long process, a five-year process of getting his body to the United States. Not a trivial exercise to the American Museum of Natural History, where he was taxidermied in fine form by George Dante, one of the best taxidermists on the planet, and then returned, well, last week to the Galapagos to great fanfare, where we hope to turn tragedy into inspiration. The park has built a beautiful facility. Thousands of people are already passing through, seeing him, hearing the story of his situation and predicament, but also the somewhat positive story of tortoise conservation in the archipelago. But that, in a nutshell, is the Lonesome George story.
We're talking with James Gibbs. He's a conservation biologist, and he directs the Roosevelt Wildlife Station at the State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry, and just returned from the Galapagos Islands. I understand you accompanied Lonesome George on that journey back to his island.
Yes, I had the good fortune both of accompanying him out of the Galapagos to New York, and then and back again, sort of as a courier. It's largely symbolic. The hard work is done by the logistics companies and all of the workers. But there's a lot of other aspects to this. For example, ensuring that his the conditions under which he's displayed are functional in the intense tropical heat. So I was more on the technical side, but did join him in spirit, and certainly also in time and space on both of his voyages out and back to the islands.
And so what are some other things you work on when you're there? Walk us through your days there on the islands.
Yes, I'm part of a larger effort called the Giant Tortoise Restoration Initiative that is really being undertaken by the Galapagos Conservancy in conjunction with the Galapagos National Park Service. And we have we've been working very hard for the last 5 years to basically try to bring forth the next phase of giant tortoise conservation. For 30 years, the park has worked very hard to stave off extinction and done some incredible work. We're now looking at what would be involved to actually recover this incredible dynasty of creatures, and their numbers, something approximating the original numbers, they're still at about 10% of their original 200,000 to 300,000. You have to get them back onto all the islands where they once occurred, and in the numbers that they once did, so they can start, being the engineers of the ecosystems that they are. This is as much about island and ecosystem restoration as is about tortoises, because they play such an important role. But in that context, we do all sorts of things. We visit these very remote islands. Some islands we're introducing tortoises, reintroducing them from captivity. We've discovered some very thought to be extinct forms on some remote places where they'd actually been moved by whalers and others. And a lot of different activities all transpiring at the same time.
Let's take a call now. Kendra from Milwaukee. Hi, Kendra.
Hi there.
What would you like?
I wanted to mention we were just in the Galapagos Islands. It was a wonderful trip. We did get to see the giant land tortoises, and we're delighted with how common they were on one of our, rare vehicle trips. I think it was on Santa Cruz. And we also saw at the Darwin Center, the breeding facility, where they're rearing, large numbers of these very tiny tortoises to a size where they can be safe in the wild.
Yeah, James, would you give us some information on this breeding program, this head starting, perhaps it might be called?
Yes, I'm glad you got to see that. It's one of the more remarkable conservation stories, not just for Galapagos, but the world. The Galapagos National Park Service has learned through trial and error how to breed tortoises in captivity, feed them the right things, and hatch their eggs and incubate them, and then rear them up to a size where they can be released back to the wild. And the idea is, in the interim, correcting the problems that the animals were facing that made them endangered in the first place. So, for example, on the island of Española, the entire population dropped to just 15 animals. And all of those, this was back in the 1970s, they were removed, and they're still alive and well and reproducing. I think the caller probably saw them as well at the station. But they produce eggs, and the park rangers take those eggs and rear them, actually in boxes of vermiculite with hair dryers, get the temperature just right. I think warmer temperatures produce females, and cooler temperatures produce males, and you can actually choose the sex of the offspring accordingly and bias it toward females to help populations grow. But when the little tortoises have reached about 5 years old, so slightly bigger than that would fit in your outstretched palm, they're basically big enough to fend for themselves and especially deal with their real nemesis, which are black rats, which are still on many islands. And those then, after that this is the definition of head starting, they're at a size where they can take care of themselves and put back in wild. We think they then follow some of the tortoises that might already be there to find the migratory routes and the places to eat and rest, but they pretty much take care of themselves. But that Española population, for example, is back up to 1,000 now, all offspring of those 15. And the big problem on that island, which was an infestation of goats, they've all been removed, all the goats. So the habitat's back and the tortoises are back. And they're starting to breed again on their own island, thanks to this long period in captivity. So just one example of how all this works, imperiled species, captive breeding, fixing the problem and getting them back again.
Well, thank you so much, Kendra, for your call. We're talking with biologist James Gibbs of State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. We're learning about conservation efforts underway on the Galapagos Islands that are saving giant tortoises from extinction and restoring their delicate island ecosystem. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about giant tortoises and the Galapagos? What impresses you about these gentle giant reptiles that can weigh hundreds of pounds? Add your voice at 800-642-1234 or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're continuing our conversation now with Professor James Gibbs. He's a conservation biologist just back from the Galapagos Islands. He's reporting to us today about the remarkable conservation efforts underway in this volcanic archipelago to save giant tortoises. You can join in this discussion at 800-642-1234 or post your thoughts and check out some amazing pictures of these iconic tortoises on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. James, besides the black rats that were threatening the tortoises, what else in the history of these giant tortoises were a threat to extinction?
Yes, they're primarily humans and invasive species. So the rats are a problem for the nestlings and the hatchling tortoises, but not for the adults. When they get to 5 years or so, they're sort of immune from rat predation. But in the other area of invasive species, invasive herbivores that basically compete with the tortoises, and we're talking mainly about goats, but also burros, have been really the problem because they completely transform the ecosystems of Galapagos. They turn rich, moist areas full of tortoise food and also shade and plants that will intercept water and create tortoise watering areas. They just denude them and turn them into dust bowls. So that has been the biggest problem over the years. Remarkably, in Galapagos, it has been said it could never be done, but goats are under control. They have been eradicated from most areas and just kept in a few for local populations to access for food. But those big problems have gone away, and the ecosystems are recovering dramatically. Humans have really been the biggest force in terms of not so much habitat, but actual populations. The whole sperm whale industry, really through the 1820s to the 1850s, based really out of the United States, especially the East here, but also California, was done on tortoise meat. The sailors would come around Cape Horn. There was no Panama Canal then, and get to Galapagos really a year after leaving their port, starving. And so stopping in Galapagos to store up on tortoises and tortoise meat was just part of the whole sperm whale industry. And when they finished whaling 2 or 3 years later, they would come back through that, and take more. And that probably accounted for, you know, we know it accounted for tens of thousands, probably 100,000 tortoises gone.
And in your piece in the conversation, there's quite a shocking photo from 1903 that shows this hillside completely filled with tortoise remains that were left over, and it looks almost like a war scene. Was this the hunting that was going on of tortoises, and what were they trying to get at, the meat?
Yes, that's even more depressing. So when the whalers had departed and the colonists started to move into the archipelago, and what you see in that photograph, and it is, as you described, just a whole landscape of just scattered with shells of giant tortoises around some small ponds. Those are tortoises that come down for a drink of water and were slaughtered. Sadly, those were slaughtered in the thousands for the fat that they have inside their shells, which could be rendered into oil to light the street lamps of some South American cities. So thousands and thousands for that particular reason. Petroleum, in some sense, saved tortoises because it provided an alternative source of lighting and all the things we used sperm whale oil for, so we didn't need tortoises anymore. But those were the big, the really real devastations. And then those colonists and the whalers, and to some extent, also left behind these black rats and goats that then continued to sort of damage populations and habitats until recently, when the efforts have been made to bring those problems under control.
Let's take another call now at 800-642-1234 with Anne from Green Bay. Hi, Anne.
Hello. See, Professor, I understand that they're going to start limiting some human people coming to the island because there's so much human traffic that it's actually starting to mess with the ecosystem. Is that something you've heard?
Yes. Galapagos is a... It does experience... A lot of people think of it as a remote place with no people and just animals, and it's advertised and defined, branded that way. But in fact, there are 30,000 residents, and those residents there are really there in support of the tourism industry, which is a couple hundred thousand people per year coming from around the world. The tourism industry has run very, very well with little direct impact, but the requirement of permanent residents to support it is the big problem. So there have been significant efforts to limit immigration to Galapagos. Its quality of life is very high, much higher than the continent, and the Galapagos has been designated a special province. It would be as if we took Alaska and said you needed a permit to go there. You couldn't live there without sort of a passport of some kind. But that is indeed the case. It's very difficult to get permission now to move there permanently. But there is, you're absolutely correct, there are issues with our human numbers and populations and this great tourism industry that generates a huge amount of profit and also helps to advance conservation, but does also require this permanent population. And people, like people everywhere, they want their pets and their children need schools and they have waste disposal issues. It's a complicated issue, but that's what it is in a nutshell.
And we have an email from Jason in Madison who wants to know how climate change is impacting the islands.
A very great question and a very complicated one, mainly because the archipelago itself is fairly small and it's at the convergence of some very complicated oceanic currents. And not to avoid the question, it's just that of all places on the planet to try and make a prediction, it's very difficult. It really depends on what happens with those oceanic currents. Galapagos is a place of extraordinary extremes. Even day to day, you can roast at midday and snuggle deep into your sleeping bag at night because of going between the equatorial sun and the Humboldt Current. But it really is, but then warm currents can move in, for example, during El Nino periods and drop as many as 2 to 3 meters of rainfall in a given year. So it's very complicated right now. We don't really know what's going on. It could end up getting a lot drier, or it could end up getting a lot wetter. At this point, we don't see any particular trend, or signal, but it's very difficult in an environment that's so variable to begin with. But, people are starting to clue in on this. But it's difficult to make a prediction for such a small archipelago, as famous and important as it is.
We're talking with conservation biologist James Gibbs. He is professor at State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry. We're looking at the scientific work being done in the Galapagos Islands to save giant tortoises from extinction and to restore their habitat. James has been involved in that effort for quite a long time, and we're learning about what the scientists are working together on. And James, this has been a really big group effort of scientists to bring back these tortoises. How much of an effort is it to have scientists all on the same page working together to get these populations back up?
Yes, it's a bit of a challenge unto itself. A lot of conservation is about how well organizations work and how well, teams of people work together, and that's been an issue here. We really are very fortunate to work with just wonderful folks who like to work together and all bring a distinct set of skills, but our larger team is comprised of, scientists like myself. We have zoo veterinarians. When health issues come up, we have people are very good planners. And then there's also a bit of a divide that needs to be crossed between scientists and their academic interests, but all the perspectives they offer, and then the managers, the on-the-ground folks day in, day out, who have to make things happen. So, but over the years, we have developed wonderful relationship with the Galapagos National Park across a language barrier as well. But I think ultimately it's the real sincere interest of the Galapagos National Park to listen and ask for advice. It's entirely their decision what to do with that advice. But there's a very openness to new ways of doing things, and because of that, we've managed to actually do things in Galapagos that not just help the archipelago and the tortoises, but are kind of pushing conservation ahead more broadly. For example, on one island, the island of Santa Fe, the whalers killed off all of the tortoises 300 years ago. There's no hope for finding any more. The park listened to and recognized this issue of tortoises as ecosystem engineers and the lack of them and the problem for the plant community for not having tortoises. And they went ahead and agreed to putting a different species of tortoise on Santa Fe to basically get the ecosystem services tortoises provided. Other parks might have said, no original tortoise, no way, we're not going to do that. So we have an analog species now on Santa Fe that we've released. We released 200 last year. Remarkably, every single one has survived and gotten a lot bigger, and another 200 to go this year. But it's a sort of wonderful, for me, return year after year to Galapagos, because as a scientist, I very much appreciate this interaction between management and government, listening to scientists. We are just our opinions, but the discussions that lead to decisions and ultimately some creative and important efforts for conservation, it's a wonderful interaction, but it does boil down to people and personalities and an eagerness to work together on a larger mission.
And when you say introducing an analog species on Santa Fe Island, what do you mean by analog?
Yes, an analog would be sort of not something analogous, so not the original form, but we've put an entirely different species on Santa Fe Island than was there originally. The original one is extinct. So this use of analog species is discussed a great deal in conservation, but not done very often. But in this case, it gets into some difficult areas, and conservation does when we talk about, you know, eradicating hundreds of thousands of goats. For tortoises, it gets into complicated ethical issues. But in this particular case, would this ecosystem, should it be left to continue to suffer without an ecosystem engineer, or should we bring in what is essentially an exotic tortoise to jumpstart the ecosystem? And it gets complicated, and there's not a common perspective on what should be done. But in this case, the decision was made that the ecosystem needed a tortoise, and even if it was an exotic one, it was important to go ahead and put it in back into the system.
Well, let's bring a call in at 800-642-1234 with Anne from Monona. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I wondered, I had two questions. One, I wondered when and from where the ancestors of the giant tortoises in the Galapagos came, since the Galapagos are not and were never part of South America. And second, I wondered if there might be some relation. I was in the Everglades about 15 years ago, and I was in a preserve area, not too far from the Everglades, sort of a prairie area on a gravel road, just totally isolated. And I heard this big scraping behind me, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and there was an absolutely huge tortoise or turtle, I don't know which, sort of ambling along the road. And I stopped the car and, you know, very slowly walked over to it, and it gave me an evil eye and decided it didn't like me much. And so it sort of climbed back into a creek, or, you know, just sort of ambled back toward a creek where I guess it lived. But anyway, I wondered if there were any, you know, possible connections between the giant tortoises of the southern United States and the Galapagos.
Yes, there actually are, and a lot of people don't realize this. The giant tortoises only occur on two places on the Earth today in the Galapagos, of course, and then on Aldabra in the Indian Ocean, and we tend to then regard them as very strange and ancient forms that somehow exist in these odd places. But the reality of it is that giant tortoises were actually everywhere, except for Antarctica. As humans move to new continents, giant tortoises are probably the very first to have disappeared. South America, for example, had, as far as we know, 5 or 6 species of giant tortoises, and actually much more giant than the ones today. So, as strange as it sounds, they may have miniaturized when they got to the Galapagos relative to what was on the continent just 10 to 12,000 years ago. So to link to your question about Florida, then you probably encountered a gopher tortoise, which is a very substantial tortoise, not quite as giant, but they do the same things. In fact, the gopher tortoises make burrows that host as many as 35 different species, so they're also ecosystem engineers. But there were giant tortoises in Florida. And when the first peoples arrived in North America, we actually have remains of tortoises with charred remains from being cooked, basically. So it puts it all in a different perspective when you think of these not just as very odd, strange creatures, but actually, until very recently, in terms of the history of life on Earth, a wink of an eye ago, they were just about everywhere.
And the first part of her question, how did they get to the Galapagos?
Ah, yes. We know, and it has been observed, for example, the big rivers in South America disgorging into the Pacific. Even today, you can, for example, be in Guayaquil and see huge rafts of vegetation go by. In all likelihood, tortoises moved off on a flood onto a raft of vegetation and floated out. Probably it happened thousands of times, but one of those times a tortoise actually fetched up on Galapagos. A tortoise is very interesting. Female tortoise, it's as crazy as it sounds that they could found a whole new lineage of animals. They are a whole new set of species. The females can carry eggs for a very long time, and they can have as many as, at this point, we know 5 to 10 different fathers for all the clutch of eggs they have internally. So you could imagine a tortoise fetching up on a beach in the Galapagos being sort of a fairly diverse gene pool. And the last thing I'd point out, we thought until recently that these animals, they're land tortoises, so they just would be in water and float around, and the currents would take them where they would. But now we know an Aldabra tortoise was actually washed off its atoll in the Indian Ocean, and it ended up in Tanzania, hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away, and it was actually seen swimming. So these animals seem to be moving very quickly. They can seem to propel themselves even in water. So a bit of chance and of course, but probably one of these more giant tortoises fell into a river, got swept out to Galapagos, happened to arrive on a beach and with eggs, and that's probably how all of this began.
Well, Ann, thanks for your questions. We're talking with conservation biologist James Gibbs of State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry. We're learning about the amazing work being done by scientists to save giant tortoises from extinction and restore their habitat. And you can join in the discussion and ask James about what's going on in this volcanic archipelago. He's just returned. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for a vacationing Kathleen Dunn, who, by the way, is not in the Galapagos Islands, but I'm sure she wishes she were. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Now we're picking up our conversation with Professor James Gibbs from the State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry. He's also an adjunct scientist for the Galapagos Conservancy and collaborator on the Giant Tortoise Movement Ecology Program. He's just back from the Galapagos with a story to share about the long and careful restoration of giant tortoises that roam these volcanic islands. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to learn about giant tortoises? What are you curious about in this conservation effort? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. And James, we have an email from 7-year-old Lucas in Eau Claire. He wants to know, how many babies do giant tortoises have at once?
A great question, Lucas. The these are they breed, we think, once a year. The females do. They're, each egg is the size of a billiard ball, and it's and they have about, it depends on the island and the tortoises, but probably between 10 and 20 eggs per year. So very big eggs, very lots of yolk in them. The females incredibly dig very delicate and complicated nests with their back feet. They can't see what they're doing, and dig these beautiful flask-shaped nests really with their toenails, and lay their eggs and then pack it all up, move the soil back over and pack it down by flattening it with their shells, and leave nature to do all the incubation. But it's a quite an amazing thing to see, a very, very ancient thing. They're doing this all, you know, all from instinct alone, but it's that's how tortoises reproduce, and very few large eggs within the shell, which causes some problems because they can't get larger or smaller. It's kind of packed in there, so that's how they do it.
And they live a very long life. Why is that?
Yes, tortoises are really interesting set of trade-offs. Basically, that shell is very impressive, and once it's constructed and built, it gives them, you know, a century of protection from all manner of things. They, you know, predators, they can store all kinds of resources inside them, but to build it is no trivial effort. It takes a lot of calcium and a lot of protein. So what turtles and these tortoises do to an extreme is they basically spend the first 2 decades of their life. We do know they can start breeding at 15, but probably age 25 is more typical. But they spend those first 2 decades just foraging to build that shell. And once it's built, then they really stop growing, and they put all their effort into reproduction. But then, because it's built and it's substantial, they can go for, we think, another 100 years. No problem, perhaps a little bit longer than that. In fact, we know for a fact they can probably get up into 150 years, which, interesting, you could think of perhaps, and possibly up to 200, some of the tortoises Charles Darwin saw may still be alive today. But that's the big trade-off with tortoises, delay reproduction in order to then enjoy it for a century.
And they're herbivores, and so they're eating a lot of plants.
They're eating amazing amounts of plants, especially grasses when they're soft. But when it's dry, they're really going for cactus, which is both got a lot of water in it, but also a lot of nutrients. They get fruits and seeds when they can. The amazing thing about tortoises, it takes about 20 days, sometimes 30 days, for a mouthful to pass through them. And during that time, they're moving quite a bit. And so they're very important seed dispersers. They also then leave those seeds in a moist package that really helps the plants grow and jumpstart the plants. So big herbivores, big seed dispersers, moving over very large areas.
And going back to these goats that now have been eliminated, the goats created this kind of dust bowl effect, eliminating habitat and food for the giant tortoises. So how did the goats get there in the first place, and what was that story?
Yeah, that story is one mainly of, it's fairly common around the world with islands where, you know, you can put a pair of goats or 3 or 5 of them on an empty island, and I'm not exaggerating. This happened on actually Lonesome George's Island, and within 15, 20 years, there were thousands of them. It's just a way that people do, you know, perhaps fishermen, others, it's a little casual, but add goats and come back in 5 years and have a source of food. And, you know, if you're not paying attention to the damages, it's a good deal. But it's an incredibly destructive practice, and it had been happened on one island after the next in Galapagos, to the point where there were so many goats that not even the fishermen wanted that many goats. So it's not then easy to remove them, and it gets into complicated issues of eradicating hundreds of thousands of goats to save tortoises, but it actually becomes that simple. The choice is that simple. Without vegetation and shade, the tortoises would go extinct eventually, as would the goats, ironically. So the park looked at these the very difficult situation, and through some very clever approaches, learned how to remove goats from huge areas on a scale that no one else has in history.
Yeah, so there was this Judas ghost, or goat, they called him, and that would lead you to the goats, the herds?
Yes. The process of removing goats is goes really in three different phases. The first is basically using helicopters and shooting from helicopters to knock down numbers to, you know, 20%, and then getting on the ground is the second phase, much harder, more dangerous work covering these islands to knock down to another 10% or 5%. The problem is those last ones, and the goats can recover very quickly. They're very smart. They're very social and intelligent animals. This is where the Judas goat technology came in, and it was developed in Galapagos. And it's those last survivors are the wiliest ones of all to catch goats and actually put a radio transmitter on them, paint up their horns a bright color so they can be distinguished from the others, and let them go. And the Judas part is, of course, the radio transmitter that's revealing the location of the Judas goat. And goats being what they are, they sort of ostracize the Judas goats for a couple of weeks, but then they eventually welcome them into the group. And you can monitor and find those last goats by following the Judas goat. And that's how they remove these last goats. And also they continue to have Judas goats on these islands as monitoring devices should anyone reintroduce goats for some reason. And that is a distinct possibility. So that's the series of approaches. It's very complex logistically, but that's how this this massive goat eradication has been accomplished in Galapagos.
Let's take another caller now at 800-642-1234. Christine in Franklin. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I have a question about the tortoises. I went scuba diving, one of my first dives, off of Hawaii, Oahu, and they had these huge turtles underneath, in the, probably about 30 feet of water, and there were, I don't know, a half dozen of them. And I'm just wondering, is that about the same size as these, or are these much larger?
Yeah, so you were looking at marine turtles. I suspect green turtles or possibly loggerheads, but that they are actually about the same diameter. The marine turtles tend to be a little more flattened because they have to swim through water, and the flatter you are, the less resistant. So, but the giant tortoises are about that size, but twice as thick or possibly even thicker. So you absolutely saw a turtle on the scale of a giant tortoise, but a dramatically flatter one. And these are two... sort of ancient lineages of turtles, really, the sea turtles, but then the tortoises are sort of are land-dwelling, and the only time they could possibly meet was when the sea turtles come up onto beaches to nest, but they're, but you did see absolutely turtles of this scale and magnitude, and they're quite magnificent.
Christine, thanks so much for your call. We also had a call from Laura in Milwaukee who's wondering, James, can you use ancient giant tortoise DNA to create a version that's closer to the original giant tortoise?
I think it's getting into genetic engineering questions. We know that giant tortoises and very giant tortoises exist, from the Pleistocene. We find their remains. They're mostly fossil remains. I do not know that anyone has actually succeeded in finding skeletal material that you could harvest DNA from to possibly embark on that. Right now, we're focused more on restoring the species that exist. Having said that, bones in museums have been utterly critical to this whole effort. Our geneticist from Yale, Gisela Cocconi, had made a discovery in one of our most remote populations of some very strange-looking tortoises, and she had no idea where they came from. And it wasn't until they extracted bones from recently extinct tortoises that she realized that they were descendants of tortoises from other islands. And it was only with that match and those museum bones that we realized that we're sitting on a gold mine to restore one, possibly two different species. So that's really how DNA from bones is being used this day in Galapagos. Very important for conservation.
And so where do things stand today? How are the various tortoise populations doing? And are you optimistic?
You know, I am fairly optimistic. This is you would call it the long game. I think we've got a lot of great projects. We're actually verging on having tortoises back on almost every island and site where they originally were, under conditions where they can now reproduce and start to grow their own populations. The thing is, it's like growing trees, and I have 15 years left in my career, so this is all going to, you know, go on long after I've retired, and it's sort of satisfying at the same time. We definitely have got tremendous momentum, and the park has done incredible things to start this longer-term recovery. Again, getting away from staving off extinctions to really the road to recovery. It's just literally going to take 100 to 200 years to get numbers back up to once they were what they once were, and I don't see why they won't get there. Climate change accepted, you know, we don't know what's coming, but everything is looking good for the tortoises to start to rebuild their numbers, and that will be a very long process.
And a few of our callers have asked how they can help from afar. What can we do in our everyday lives to help in any way?
Well, certainly being aware of all of these exciting things happening, visiting Galapagos, in order to enter the Galapagos, you need to pay not an inordinate, but a substantial fee, and that goes straight to conservation for the most part. There are certain very active, I don't want to sound like I'm promoting, but the Galapagos Conservancy, you know, really depends entirely on $20 donations from concerned individuals who really care about this work, and that's really that's pushing all of this ahead. It does take the Park Service invest tremendously, but donations from individuals help as well. I think just spreading the news. I would say this, you know, I'm not trying to paint too bright a picture, but there's lots of really exciting things happening, and we do dwell heavily on the very negative and bad news for biodiversity and species around the world. But there's exciting things going here, and if there's anything I had hoped that would come out of this, would be a larger hope for when people come together and really look hard at problems, that you can succeed and recover species. But that's really depends on a lot of public support and interest.
Are there conservation lessons learned that you've learned in the Galapagos and your fellow scientists, and in the case of giant tortoises, that can be applied elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, we, in some ways, what we're seeing in Galapagos confirms that, for example, captive breeding, if it's truly combined with an effort to correct the problem that made species endangered in the first place, if that's done well, you can recover species. We've seen that twice in Galapagos. We do think, it's clear that these tortoises are more than just interesting animals. They do important things. We do need to pay attention to the ecological importance of doing this kind of work. And then to be open to surprises, you know, we've discovered this thicket of tortoises that seem to be descendants of two thought to be extinct species. So, paying attention to surprises, working across disciplines, the geneticists have really revealed this for the initiative. I think, and last, the use of analog species. If you've lost a species, but it is possible to restore some of those critical roles they played in the environment with other species. It's complicated, but it can be done in all of those sort of four areas we've seen, transpire with this giant tortoise restoration effort.
And do you know when you will be headed back to the Galapagos and what your work will entail?
Well, yes, I already have the next trip booked for
itinerary.
May and June. We will go back and release the next 200 little tortoises to Santa Fe Island and check on the ones that we released previously and do other work. We've built some big exclosures to keep tortoises out of some areas, actually measure what they do to vegetation to better understand and communicate the importance of conserving them. That's the big task for the next phases now that Lonesome George is back home again.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure for me. Thank you.
Professor James Gibbs is a conservation biologist at the State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry. He's also a research collaborator on a giant tortoise movement ecology program in the Galapagos, where he's also an adjunct scientist for the Galapagos Conservancy. We can continue this discussion over on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, where we have a link to an article by James Gibbs on this effort. Monday at this time, it's All Things Political. We'll talk about the latest political news, including recent revelations that Senator Jeff Sessions spoke with Russian ambassador at least twice, despite his confirmation hearing testimony. We'll also unpack President Trump's first speech to Congress. Orrin Cass of the Manhattan Institute will be our guest. That's Monday at 1. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show, with on-air production help today from Cheryl Gasser and technical direction from Dave Potraz. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.